Speak up now, apologize, and we'll put the entire incident behind us. Silence follows, broken by a few coughs and the occasional squeak of a cafeteria chair. No girls stand to confess. Not that I was expecting it. Most teenage girls would rather die than admit they did something wrong. I should know. I survey the crowd from my spot by the door. Most of the girls have their heads bowed in collective shame. The few who don't stare ahead with wide-eyed innocence, including Crystal and Sasha. Miranda is the only girl from Dogwood who seems pissed off by the incident. She sneaks glances at the girls around her, trying to find the guilty culprit. Standing along the wall are Lottie, Theo, Chet, and Mindy. Mindy catches me looking and gives me a scowl. I have officially ruined her goal of things running smoothly. "Well then," Franny says after a suitably unbearable length of time, "my disappointment only grows. After breakfast, all of you will return to your cabins. Morning classes are canceled while we sort everything out." She makes her way out of the mess hall with the rest of the lodge denizens in tow. When they pass, Lottie taps my shoulder and says, "Emma, please come with us." I follow them to the arts and crafts building next door. Once everyone's inside, Lottie closes the door. I stand next to it, my body coiled, resisting the urge to sprint. Not just from the room, but from the camp itself. My left hand started trembling the moment I saw the paint on the door, and it hasn't stopped since. The birds around my wrist rattle. "Well, this is a fine mess," Franny says. "Emma, do you have any idea who could have done this?" The obvious answer would be someone in this room. A major clue lies in the painted word currently being scrubbed off Dogwood's door. Other than Mindy, I've lied to all of them in the past. About Theo, about what I accused him of doing, and while none of them have called me a liar to my face, I wouldn't be surprised if they all felt that way in private. I wouldn't blame them either. Yet my gut tells me none of them are responsible. They're the ones who invited me back here, after all, and petty vandalism seems beneath a member of the Harris White clan. If they wanted to be rid of me, they'd just say so. I don't know. I debate telling them about the person I saw at the window. Call it paranoia from Vivian's diary rubbing off on me, but I'm not sure I can trust anyone with the truth. Not until I get a better grasp of what's going on. There's a chance that, considering my history, no one will believe it's happening at all unless I have more proof. I only knew about it once I left the cabin. Franny turns to her younger son. "Chet, did you check the camera?" "Yeah," he says while swiping the hair from over his eyes. "There's nothing, which is a big red flag. The slightest motion triggers that camera." "But someone had to be outside that cabin," I say. "That door didn't paint itself." "Is the camera working now?" Franny asks, keeping her tone calm to counter my growing shrillness. "Yes," Chet says, "which means it either malfunctioned overnight or someone tampered with it. I imagine it wouldn't be too hard to climb up there on a ladder and put tape over the sensor."
"Wouldn't there be video of that?" Theo says.
Chet answers with a shake of his head.
"Not necessarily. The camera is programmed to automatically turn on at 9 p.m. and turn off at 6 in the morning. Someone could have tampered with it before 9 and removed the tape right at 6.
Franny then fixes her green-eyed gaze on me. Although current circumstances have dimmed it slightly, I still feel trapped by her stare. "Emma, have you told anyone else about the camera?"
"No, but that doesn't mean people don't know about it. If I noticed it, then others probably did too." "Let's talk about the paint," Theo says. "If we can figure out where it came from, maybe it'll give us a better idea of who did it."
"Emma's the painter," Mindy pipes up. "She's the one with the most access to it."
"Oil paint," I say, shooting her an angry look. and that's not what was on the door. It doesn't run like that. If I had to guess, I'd say it was acrylic paint.
What's it used for? Theo says.
I look to the center of the room, where Casey's workstation sits. All those cabinets and cubbyholes filled with supplies.
Crafts, I say.
I edge around one of the circular crafting tables and head to the cabinet against the wall behind it. Flinging it open, I see rows of plastic paint bottles. They're translucent, giving a glimpse of the colors contained within them. All the bottles are full, save for one. Basic red. Sitting nearby is a trash can. I go to it and spot a medium-sized paintbrush at the bottom. Red paint clings to the bristles, still wet.
See, I say, not my paint, not my brush.
So someone snuck in here early this morning and used the paint, Theo says.
The door is locked overnight, Lottie replies. At least it's supposed to be. Maybe whoever was last to leave yesterday forgot to lock it.
Or has a key, Chet adds.
Lottie shakes her head. The only people with keys are me, Franny, and Ben.
Neither Lottie nor I would do such a thing, Franny says, and Ben was only just arriving when the paint was discovered.
So that means the door was left unlocked, Theo says.
Maybe not, Mindy says. Yesterday, while everyone was going to lunch, I caught Emma snooping around the other workstations.
All eyes turn to me, and I wilt in the heat of their stares. I take a step back, bump into a plastic chair, drop into it. Mindy looks at me with a sad, scrunched face, as if to show how much making the accusation has pained her.
You honestly think I'm the one who did this? I say.
Why would I vandalize my own door?
Why have you done a lot of things?
Although Mindy says it, I assume that question has occurred to everyone in the room at some point. They might not have spoken it aloud like Mindy, but it's been asked all the same. It's in every look of Franny's green eyes. It's in the red light of the camera that blinks on when I enter Dogwood. I have every reason to believe they'd forgiven me. It doesn't mean any of them trust me. Except for maybe Theo, who says,
If Emma says she didn't do it, then I believe her. What we should be doing is asking why someone would do this to her.
I know the answer. But like that unspoken question, it's one I can't say aloud. It's there all the same, visible in my still shaking hands. Because someone at camp knows. That's why I was watched in the shower. Why those three birds were released into the cabin. Why someone was at the window and smeared paint across the door. It was their way of telling me that they know. Not what I did to Theo. What I did to the girls. The realization keeps me pinned to the flimsy chair, even after everyone starts to leave. Before exiting, Theo looks at me with concern, his cheeks flushed enough to make his scar stand out.
Are you okay?
He says.
No. I picture Vivian, Natalie, and Allison as paint marks on one of my canvases, waiting for me to cover them up. One of the reasons I came back here is because I couldn't keep doing that, because I thought that if I learned more about what happened to them, my conscience would be clean. But now I can't foresee spending an entire 6 weeks here. Whoever's been watching me will continue to do so, stepping up the reminders bit by bit. Trapped birds and paint on the door, I fear, are only the beginning. If there are answers to be found, I have to do it quickly.
I need to get out of here, just for a little bit.
Where do you want to go? Theo says.
I think of Vivian's diary and the call letters of a book.
Town, I say.
15 years ago. The radio, like the rest of the truck, had seen better days. The little music that did fizz from the speaker sounded tinny and pockmarked with static.
Not that it mattered. The only radio station Vivian and I could find played nothing but country music, the steel guitar and fiddle twang accompanying our journey out of Camp Nightingale.
"So, why are we doing this again?"
Theo asked as the truck passed under the camp's entrance arch. "Because I'm in need of some hygiene products," Vivian said. "Personal lady ones."
"That's more than I need to know."
Theo shook his head, amused in spite of himself.
"What about you, Em?"
"I'm just along for the ride." And I was, quite unexpectedly. I had been waiting for the others outside the mess hall, the pollen from Vivian's forget-me-nots still dusting my fingertips, when Natalie and Allison arrived. "Vivian needs you," Allison said.
"Why?"
She didn't say.
"Where is she?"
Natalie jerked her head toward the arts and crafts building on her way inside.
"Over there."
That's where I found Vivian, Theo, and the mint-green pickup. Vivian was already inside, drumming her fingers against the sill of the open window. Theo leaned against the driver's side door, his arms crossed.
"Hey there, latecomer," he said. "Hop in."
I squeezed between the two of them, their bodies warm against me, as the truck bucked along the pothole-riddled road. Theo's legs continually bumped mine, as did his arm whenever he turned the steering wheel. Downy hairs from his forearm tickled my skin. The sensation made my stomach flutter and heart ache as if they were being filled beyond capacity, becoming too large for my scrawny frame. It stayed that way the entire drive into town, which had no discernible name but could have been any small town anywhere in the country. There was a main drag, quaint storefronts, red, white, and blue bunting on porches. We passed a town green with its generic war memorial and a sign promising a parade the next morning and fireworks at night. Theo parked the truck, and Vivian and I quickly hopped out, stretching our legs, pretending the journey was uncomfortable, a burden. Better that than to have let Theo think I enjoyed his accidental touches. Properly stretched, Vivian started to cross the street, heading toward an old-timey drugstore on the corner.
"I'll see you losers in an hour," she said.
"An hour?" Theo said. Vivian kept walking. "I plan to enjoy my freedom by going shopping. Maybe I'll buy myself something pretty. You and Emma go get lunch or something." She strode into the pharmacy without another word. Through the window, I watched her pause at a rack of cheap sunglasses by the door and try on a pair shaped like hearts.
"Well, I guess it's just us," Theo said, turning my way. "You hungry?"
We walked to a diner that was as sleek and shiny as a bullet and settled into a booth by the window. Theo ordered a cheeseburger, fries, and a vanilla milkshake. I did the same, minus the milkshake, which Vivian never would have approved of in a million years. While we waited for the food, I stared out the window and watched cars lazily cruise up and down the street, their lowered windows revealing kids, dogs, harried mothers behind the wheel. Even though he was across the table from me, I didn't want to look at Theo too much. Each time I did glance his way, I pictured him in the latrine shower, glistening and beautiful and oblivious to my prying gaze. The image brought a shameful warmth to my face, my stomach, between my legs. I wondered if Vivian knew that was going to happen when she urged me to peek between those ill-spaced cedar planks. I hoped not. Otherwise, it just seemed cruel. And Vivian wasn't cruel, despite sometimes appearing that way. She was my friend, my summer camp big sister. As I sat there with Theo, listening to oldies drift from a corner jukebox, I understood that the whole trip was Vivian's ruse to let me spend time alone with him. Another apology, one better than flowers.
"How are you liking Camp Nightingale?" Theo asked once the food had arrived.
"I love it," I said, taking a rabbit-like nibble on a French fry.
"My mother will be pleased to hear that."
"Do you like it there?" Theo took a bite of burger, leaving a smudge of ketchup on the corner of his mouth. I resisted the urge to swipe it off with the flick of my finger.
I love it, too. Unfortunately, this looks like it'll be my last summer before internships take over my life. College certainly keeps you busy, especially when you're pre-med.
You're going to be a doctor?
That's the plan. A pediatrician.
That's so noble, I said. I think it's great you want to help people.
And what do you want to be?
I think I want to be a painter.
I don't know why I said it. I certainly had no artistic ambitions I didn't quite know what to do with. It just sounded like the kind of profession Theo would want a woman to have.
It was adult and sophisticated, like something from a movie.
Emma Davis, famous painter. That has a nice ring to it.
Theo gave me a smile that made my legs quiver.
Maybe I'll come to one of your gallery openings.
Within seconds, I had my entire future mapped out. We'd keep in touch after the summer, exchanging letters that would become more meaningful as time passed. Love would eventually be declared, plans would be made. We'd have sex for the first time on my 18th birthday, preferably in a candlelit room at some exotic locale. We'd stay devoted as I went to art school and he completed his residency. Then we'd marry and be the kind of couple other people envied. As outlandish as it seemed, I told myself it could come true. I was mature for my age, or so I thought. Smart, cool, like Vivian, and I knew exactly what she would have done in that situation. So when Theo attempted to take a sip of his milkshake, I beat him to it, leaning in and sucking from his straw. The move was bold, so utterly unlike me. I blushed, my face turning the same shade of peachy pink as the lip gloss I left behind on Theo's straw. Yet there was more boldness in store. The kind of thing I never would have attempted had I spent even a fraction of a second thinking about it. But I didn't think. I simply acted, closing my eyes and tilting my mouth toward Theo's, the vanilla taste on my tongue spreading to my lips as I kissed him. His breath was hot, his lips were cold. The warmth and chill merged into a sweet, fluttery sensation that filled my body. I pulled away quickly, my eyes still closed. I didn't want to look at Theo. I didn't want to see his reaction and bring an end to the magic spell I was under. He ended it anyway, softly saying,
"I'm flattered, Emma. I really am, but..."
"I was just kidding," I blurted out, my eyes still squeezed shut as my heart twisted inside my chest. "It was a joke, that's all." Theo said nothing, which is why I leaned back in the booth, turning to the window before opening my eyes. Vivian was on the other side of the glass, her presence an unwelcome surprise. She stood on the sidewalk, wearing the drugstore sunglasses, heart-shaped frames, dark lenses reflecting diner chrome. Although I couldn't see her eyes, the smile that played across her lips made it clear she had witnessed everything. I couldn't tell if she was happy about what she saw or amused by it. Maybe it was both. Just like during her games of two truths and a lie, it was sometimes hard to tell the difference. 21. My excuse for going into town was to fill a prescription for allergy medicine I'd forgotten to bring with me. Yet another lie. At this point, I've fallen off the truth wagon completely. But again, I consider it justified, especially because it gave me the chance to return to Dogwood and grab my backpack and Vivian's diary. By then, the paint on the door had been completely wiped away. The only evidence it had been there at all was a swath of freshly cleaned wood and the nose-tickling smell of turpentine. Now Theo and I ride in the same mint-green pickup that had whisked us out of camp 15 years ago. Inside, all is silent, the radio apparently having died years ago. Theo drives with one hand on the steering wheel, his bent elbow jutting out the open window. My window is also rolled down. I stare at the woods as we leave Camp Nightingale, the trees a blur, light sparking through their branches. I'm long past being mad at Theo about the camera outside Dogwood. My silence stems not from anger, but from guilt. It's the first time we've been alone together since I learned about his breakdown, and I'm not sure how to act. There's so much I want to ask. If he felt as lonely during his 6 months of rehab as I did in a mental hospital. If he thinks about me every time he sees his scar in the mirror. With questions like that, silence seems to be the best choice. The truck hits a whopper of a pothole and both of us bounce toward the center of the bench seat. When our legs touch, I quickly pull away, edging as far as the passenger door will allow. "Sorry," I say. More silence follows, tense and thick with things unspoken. It becomes too much for Theo, for he suddenly says, "Can we start over?" I wrinkle my brow, confused. "You mean go back to camp?" "I mean go back to the beginning. Let's start fresh. Pretend it's 15 years ago and you're just arriving at camp." Theo flashes the same crooked smile he gave when we first met. "Hi, I'm Theo." Once again, I'm amazed by his forgiveness. Maybe all bitterness and anger left him the instant that car smashed into a tree. Whatever the reason, Theo's a better person than me. My default reaction to being hurt is to hurt right back, as he well knows. "Feel free to play along," he urges. I'd love nothing more than to erase much of what's happened between then and now. To rewind back to a time when Vivian, Natalie, and Allison still existed. Theo was still the dreamiest boy I'd ever seen, and I was a knock-kneed innocent, nervous about camp. But the past clings to the present, all those mistakes and humiliations following us as we march inevitably forward. There's no ignoring them. "Thank you for doing this," I say instead. "I know it's an inconvenience." Theo keeps his eyes on the road, trying to hide how I've disappointed him yet again. "It's nothing. I needed to go into town anyway. Lottie gave me a list of things to pick up from the hardware store. And what Lottie demands, she gets. She's the one who really runs this place. Always has been." When we reach town, I see it's more or less the same as I had left it, although some of the charm has been rubbed away. No patriotic bunting hangs from porch railings. A couple of empty storefronts mar the main drag, and the diner is gone, replaced by a Dunkin' Donuts. The drugstore remains, although it's now part of a chain, the name spelled out in red letters, garishly placed against the building's original brick exterior. After this, I might make a quick stop at the library. I need a place with good Wi-Fi to catch up on work emails, I say, aiming for breeziness, as if the idea has just occurred to me. I guess it works because Theo doesn't question the idea. Instead, he says, "Sure, I'll meet you there in an hour." He remains in the idling truck, watching. This gives me no choice but to keep up the ruse and hurry into the drugstore. Since I know it'll look suspicious on the return trip if I'm not carrying a bag from the place, I spend a few minutes browsing the shelves for something small to buy. I settle on a 4-pack of disposable phone chargers, one for me and each girl in Dogwood. Franny will never know. Even if she does, I'm not sure I care. At the cash register, I notice a rotating rack of sunglasses, the kind with a tilted mirror on top so customers can see how they look in the dime store shades. I give it a spin, barely eyeing the knockoff Ray-Bans and cheap aviators when a familiar pair whirls by. Red plastic. Heart-shaped frames. I snatch the sunglasses from the rack and turn them over in my hands, remembering the pair Vivian wore the entire ride back to camp that long ago summer. I spent the whole drive wondering what she was thinking. Vivian said little during the return trip, preferring instead to stare out the open window as the breeze whipped her hair across her face. I try on the sunglasses and lift my face to the rack's mirror, checking how they look. Vivian wore them better, that's for damn sure. On me, they're just silly. I look exactly like what I am, a woman approaching 30 in cheap shades made for someone half her age. I toss the sunglasses onto the counter anyway. I pay with cash and stuff the disposable chargers into my backpack. The sunglasses are worn out of the store, slid high up my forehead to keep my hair in place. I think Vivian would approve. Next, it's on to the library, which sits a block back from the main street. Inside, I pass the usual blonde wood tables and elderly patrons at desktop computers on my way to the reference desk. There, a friendly librarian named Diana points me to the nonfiction section, and soon I'm scanning the stacks for 150.97768 West. Astonishingly, it's still there, tucked tightly on a shelf of books about mental illness and its treatment. If the subject matter didn't already make me uneasy, the title certainly would. Dark Ages, Women and Mental Illness in the 1800s, by Amanda West. The cover is stark, black letters on a white background. Very 70s, which is when the book was printed. The publisher is a university press I've never heard of, which makes it even more baffling as to how or why Vivian learned of its existence. I take the book to a secluded cubicle in the corner, pausing for a few steadying breaths before opening it. Vivian read this book. She held it in her hands, mere days before she disappeared. Knowing this makes me want to put it back on the shelf, walk away, find Theo, and return to camp. But I can't. I need to open the book and see what Vivian saw. So I fling it open, seeing on the first page a vintage photo of a young woman confined in a straitjacket. Her legs are nothing but skin covering bone, her cheeks are beyond gaunt, and her hair is wild. Yet her eyes blaze with defiance. As wide as half dollars, they stare at the photographer as if willing him to look at her, really look, and understand her predicament. It's a startling image, like a kick in the stomach. A shocked huff of air lodges in my throat, making me cough. Below the photo is a caption as sad as it is vague. Unknown asylum patient, 1887. I turn the page, unable to gaze at the image any longer. Just the latest person who could bear to look at this unnamed woman for only a brief amount of time. In my own way, I've also failed her. Skimming through the book is an exercise in masochism. There are more photos, more infuriating captions. There are tales of women being committed because their husbands abused them, their families didn't want them, polite society didn't want to see them. There are accounts of beatings, of starvation, of cold baths and scrubbings with wire brushes on skin that hadn't seen daylight in months. Each time I find myself gasping at a new horror, I realize how lucky I am. Had I been born 100 years earlier, I would have become one of these women. Misunderstood and suffering, hoping that someone would figure out why my mind betrayed me and thus be able to fix it. Most of these women never enjoyed such a fate. They suffered in sorrow and confusion until the end of their days, whereas my madness was temporary. It left me. The shame is another story. After a half hour of torturous skimming, I finally come to page 164, the one Vivian noted in her diary. It contains another photo, one that fills most of the page. Like the others in the book, it bears the same sepia-toned fuzziness of something taken a century ago. But unlike those images of anonymous girls imprisoned within asylum walls, this photograph shows a man standing in front of an ornate Victorian structure. The man is young, tall, thick of chest and stomach. He boasts an impeccably waxed mustache and a distinct darkness to his eyes. One hand grips the lapel of his morning coat. The other is slid into a vest pocket. Such a pompous pose. The building behind him is 3 stories tall, made of brick with dormer windows on the top floor and a chimney-like turret gracing the roof. The windows are tall and arched. A weather vane in the shape of a rooster rises from the turret's peaked roof. A less showy wing shoots off from the building's left side. It has only one floor, no windows, patchy grass instead of a lawn. Even without the utilitarian wing, there's something off about the place. Brittle strands of dead ivy cling to a corner. Sunlight shining onto the windows have made them opaque. It reminds me of an Edward Hopper painting, House by the Railroad, the one that's rumored to have inspired the house from Psycho. All three structures project the same aura of homespun menace. Beneath the photo is a caption, Dr. Charles Cutler poses outside Peaceful Valley Asylum, circa 1898. The name summons a memory from 15 years ago. Vivian and I, alone in the woods, reading the tiny name engraved on the bottom of a rotting box. Peaceful Valley. I remember being curious about it. Clearly Vivian was, too, for she came here looking for more information. And what she learned was that Peaceful Valley had been an insane asylum. I wonder if that realization stunned her as much as it does me. I wonder if she also sat blinking in disbelief at the page in front of her, trying to wrap her head around how a box of scissors from an insane asylum ended up on the banks of Lake Midnight. I wonder if her heart raced as much as mine does, or if her legs also suddenly started to twitch. That sense of shock subsides when I look at the text on the page opposite the photo. Someone had drawn a pencil line beneath two paragraphs. Vivian, most likely. She was the kind of person who'd have no problem defacing a library book, especially if she found something important. By the end of the 19th century, a growing divide had formed regarding the treatment of mentally ill women. In the nation's cities, asylums remained crowded with the poor and indigent, who, despite a growing call for reform, still lived in deplorable conditions and were subjected to harsh treatment from undertrained and underpaid staff. It was quite a different story for the wealthy, who turned to enterprising physicians opening small, for-profit asylums that operated without government control or assistance. These retreats, as they were commonly known, usually existed on country estates in areas remote enough for family members to send troubled relatives without fear of gossip or scandal. As a result, they paid handsomely to have these black sheep whisked away and cared for. A few progressive doctors, appalled by the extreme difference in care between the rich and the poor, attempted to bridge the gap by opening the doors of their bucolic retreats to those less fortunate. For a time, Dr. Charles Cutler was a common sight in the asylums of New York and Boston, where he sought out patients in the most unfortunate of situations, became their legal guardian, and whisked them away to Peaceful Valley Asylum, a small retreat in upstate New York. According to the diary of a doctor at New York's notorious Blackwell's Island Asylum, Dr. Cutler intended to prove that a more genteel course of care could benefit all mentally ill women and not just the wealthy. While I'm almost positive this is what Vivian was pointing to in her diary, I have no idea what it has to do with Franny. In all likelihood, it doesn't. So why was Vivian so convinced that it did? There seems to be only one way to find out. I need to search the lodge. Vivian discovered something in the study there before Lottie came in and disrupted her. Whatever she found led her here, to this same book in this same library. Always leave a trail of breadcrumbs. That's what Vivian told me. So you know how to find your way back. Only I can't help but think that the trail she left for me won't be enough. I'll need a little help from a friend. I grab my phone and immediately FaceTime Mark. He answers in a rush, his voice almost drowned out by the cacophony in his bistro's kitchen. Behind him, a line cook mans a skillet that sizzles and pops. It's a bad time, I know, I tell him. The lunch rush, Mark says. I've got exactly 1 minute. I dive right in. Remember that reference librarian at the New York Public Library you used to date?
Billy? Of course. He was like a nerdy Matt Damon.
Are the two of you still friendly?
Define friendly.
Would he try to get a restraining order if he saw you again?
He follows me on Twitter, Mark says. That's not a restraining order level of animosity.
Do you think he'd help you do some research for your best friend in the entire world?
Possibly. What will we be researching?
Peaceful Valley Asylum. Mark blinks a few times, no doubt wondering if he's heard me correctly.
I guess camp's not going so well?
I quickly tell him about Vivian, her diary of cryptic clues, the fact that an insane asylum, of all things, might be involved. I think Vivian might have found something before she disappeared, Mark, something that someone else didn't want her to know.
About an asylum?
Maybe, I say. In order to be sure, I need to know more about that asylum. Mark pulls his phone closer to his face until all I can see is one large, squinting eye.
Where are you?
The local library.
Well, someone there is watching you.
Mark moves the phone even closer.
A hot someone.
My eyes dart to the lower corner of my screen, where my own image rests in a tiny rectangle. A man stands roughly 10 feet behind me, his arms folded across his chest. Theo. I need to go, I tell Mark before ending the call. As his image cuts out, I get a 1-second glimpse of his face, which is stony with concern. It's the opposite of Theo's expression. When I finally turn around to face him, his face is a placid surface, unreadable.
Are you ready to go?
He says, his voice as blank as his features.
Or do you need more time?
Nope, I reply. All done. I gather my things, leaving the book where it is. Its contents are stamped on my memory. On our way out of the library, I pull the sunglasses over my eyes, shielding them not only from the mid-afternoon glare, but from Theo's inquisitive gaze. The expression on his face hasn't wavered once since he caught me talking to Mark. The least I can do is match him in opaqueness.
Nice sunglasses, he says once we're in the truck.
Thanks, I reply, even though it didn't sound like a compliment. Then we're off, heading back to camp in a fresh cocoon of silence. I'm not sure what it means. Nothing good, I assume. Gregariousness is second nature to Theo. Or I could simply be projecting, letting Vivian's diary entries seep into my psyche and make me paranoid. Then again, considering what happened to her, Natalie, and Allison, maybe a little paranoia isn't such a bad thing. It's only when the camp's gates slide into view that Theo says,
I need to ask you something about that summer.
I already know he's going to bring up my false accusation against him. It's like barbed wire that's been stretched between us, invisible yet keenly felt whenever one of us nudges against it. Rather than respond, I roll down the window and turn my face toward the breeze, letting it tangle my hair just like Vivian's.
It's about that day we drove into town, he continues.
I exhale into the rush of warm air hitting my face, relieved to not have to talk about why I had accused him, at least for now.
What about it? Well, we had lunch at that diner and
I kissed you. Theo chuckles at the memory. I don't. It's hard to laugh at one of the most humiliating moments of your adolescence.
Yes, that. Were you lying, then, about it being a joke?
Rather than continue the lie, dragging it into a second decade, I say, why?
Because at the time, I didn't think it was.
Theo pauses, rubbing the salt-and-pepper stubble on his chin until he can summon the right words.
But I was flattered, and I want you to know that had you been older, I probably would have kissed you back.
The same boldness I had felt in that diner returns out of nowhere, I think it might be the sunglasses. I feel different with them on. More direct, less afraid. I feel, I realize, like Vivian. And now, I say.
Theo steers the truck to its spot behind the Arts and Crafts building. As it shudders to a stop, he says,
"What about now?"
"I'm older. If I kissed you now, would you kiss me back?"
A grin spreads across Theo's face, and for a split second, it's like we've been shuttled back in time, all those intervening years yet to be experienced. He's 19 and the most handsome man I'd ever seen in my life. I'm 13 and smitten, and every glimpse of him makes my heart explode into a flock of butterflies.
"You'll have to try it again sometime and see for yourself," he says.
I want to, especially when he glances my way, a flirty glint in his eyes. That grin spreading wider until his lips part, practically begging to be kissed. It's enough to make me lean across the pickup's bench seat and do just that. Instead, I step out of the car and say, "That's probably not the best idea."
Theo and the prospect of kissing him is a distraction. And now that I'm inching closer to learning what Vivian was looking for, I can't be distracted. Not by Theo, not by what I did to him. And especially not by the lies both of us have told, but aren't yet brave enough to admit.
22. That evening, the girls and I eat dinner at a picnic table outside the mess hall. The whole camp is still buzzing about the paint on the door. Liar Gate is what they're calling it, giving the incident the proper ring of scandal. I assume Casey, Becca, and the other instructors are also talking about it, which is why I'm fine with dining outdoors. I'm in no mood for their gossip.
"Where did you go this afternoon?" Sasha asks me.
"Into town."
"Why?"
"Why do you think?" Miranda snaps. "She did it to get away from this place."
Sasha swats at a fly buzzing around her tray of gray meatloaf and lumpy mashed potatoes.
"Do you think one of the campers did it?"
"It sure wasn't one of the counselors," Crystal says.
"Some of the girls are saying you did it," Sasha tells me.
"Well, they're wrong," I say. Across the picnic table, Miranda's face hardens. For a second, I think she's going to storm into the mess hall and punch the offending campers. She certainly looks ready for a fight.
"Why would Emma paint liar across our door?"
"Why would anyone do it?" Sasha asks.
Miranda answers before I get the chance, giving an answer far more pointed than mine.
"Because some girls," she says, "are just basic bitches."
After dinner, I present them with their disposable chargers. "For emergencies only," I say, even though I know all that extended battery life will be wasted on Snapchat, Candy Crush, and Crystal's beloved superhero movies. Still, it puts the girls in a good mood as we head off to the nightly campfire. They deserve it after what they've endured today. The fire pit is located on the outskirts of camp, as far away from the cabins as the property will allow. It sits in a round meadow that looks carved from the forest like a crop circle. In its center is the fire pit itself, a circle within a circle, ringed by rocks hauled out of the woods and arranged there almost a century ago. The fire is already burning when we arrive, the engulfed logs placed in an upright triangle like a teepee. The four of us sit together on one of the sagging benches placed near the blaze. We roast marshmallows on twigs whittled to sharpness by Chet's Swiss Army knife, the handles sticky, the tips crusted and charred.
"You went here when you were our age, right?" Sasha asks.
"I did."
"Did you have campfires?"
"Of course," I say, pulling a freshly roasted marshmallow off my stick and popping it into my mouth. Although the hot sugar burns my tongue, it's not an unwelcome sensation. It brings back memories, both good and bad. During my first tragedy-shortened time here, I loved the campfire. It was hot,
powerful, just the right amount of intimidating. I loved feeling its heat on my skin and watching the way it glowed white in the center. The burning logs popped and sizzled, like something alive, fighting the flames until they finally collapsed in a pile of embers, sending tiny dots of fire swirling upward.
"Why didn't you like this place again?" Miranda says.
"It's not the place I didn't like," I tell her. "It's what happened while I was here."
"Someone vandalized the cabin back then, too?"
"No," I say.
"Did you see ghosts?"
Sasha asks, her eyes shiny and wide behind her glasses.
"Because Lake Midnight is haunted, you know."
"Bullshit," Crystal says with a sniff.
"It's not. People really believe it," Sasha says. "A lot of people, especially once those girls vanished."
My body tenses. The girls. That's who she's referring to. Vivian and Natalie and Allison. I had hoped their disappearance would somehow elude this new group of campers.
"Disappeared from where?" Crystal says. "Right here," Sasha replies. "It's why Camp Nightingale closed in the first place. Three campers snuck out of their cabin, got lost in the woods, and died or something. Now their spirits roam the forest. On nights when the moon is full, they can be seen walking among the trees, trying to find the way back to their cabin." In truth, it was inevitable that the missing girls of Dogwood would pass into legend. They're now as much a part of Camp Nightingale lore as Buchanan Harris's flooded valley and the villagers caught in the water's path. I picture the current campers whispering about them at night, huddled under sleeping bags, nervous eyes flicking to the cabin window.
"That's not true," Crystal says. "It's just a dumbass story to frighten people from going into the woods, like that stupid movie by the guy who made The Sixth Sense." Miranda, not to be outdone, pulls out her phone and holds it to her ear, pretending to answer it. "It's the creepy ghost girls calling," she announces to Sasha. "They said you're a terrible liar." Later in the night, after the girls have gone to sleep, I remain awake in my bottom bunk, irritated and restless. The heat is partly to blame. It's a stifling, stuffy night made worse by a lack of airflow inside the cabin. I insisted on keeping the window closed and the door locked. After this morning, it felt like a necessary precaution. That's the other reason I can't sleep. I'm worried that whoever is watching me will make a repeat appearance, and I worry more about what they plan to do next. So I keep my gaze trained on the window, staring out at heat lightning flashing in the distance. Each flash brightens the cabin in throbbing intervals, a strobe light painting the walls in an incandescent white. During one blinding burst, I see something at the window. Perhaps, because the flash of lightning is so quick I can't quite tell. All I get is the briefest of glimpses. Half a glimpse, really. Just enough to make me think once again that someone is there, standing completely still, peering into the cabin. I want to be wrong. I want it to be just the jagged shadows of the trees outside. But when the lightning returns, arriving in a bright flash that lingers for seconds, I realize I'm right. There is someone at the window. A girl. I can't see her face. The lightning backlights her, turning her into a silhouette. Yet there's something familiar about her. The slenderness of her neck and shoulders. The slick tumble of her hair. Her poise. Vivian. It's her. I'm sure of it. Only it's not the Vivian who could exist today. It's the one I knew 15 years ago, unchanged. The Vivian who haunted me in my youth, prompting me to bury her in my paintings time and time again. Same white dress, same preternatural poise. Held in her fist is a bouquet of forget-me-nots, which she holds out formally, like a silent film suitor. My right hand flies first to my chest, feeling the frightened thrum of my heart. Then it drops to my left arm, seeking out the bracelet around my wrist. I give it a sharp tug. "I know you're not real," I whisper. I pull harder, the bracelet digging into my skin. The bird charms clatter together, a muted clicking sound almost drowned out by my panicked whispers. You have no power over me. More tugging, more clicking. I'm stronger than everyone realizes. The bracelet breaks. I hear a snap of the clasp, followed by the sensation of the chain slithering off my wrist. I fumble for it, catching it in my palm, squeezing my fingers around it. At the window, lightning flashes again, a burst of blinding light that quickly fizzles into darkness. All I see outside are a smattering of trees and a sliver of lake in the distance. No one is at the window. The sight should bring relief, but with the bracelet now a curl of chain in my fist, it brings only more fear. That Vivian will come again. If not tonight, then soon. I'm stronger than everyone realizes, I think, repeating it in my head like a mantra. I'm stronger than everyone realizes. I'm strong. By the time I fall asleep, my heart hammering, body rigid, hand tight around my abused bracelet, the chant has mutated into something else. Less reassuring, more panicked, the words pinging against my skull. I'm not going crazy. I'm not going crazy. I'm not going crazy. 15 years ago. In the morning, instead of reveille blaring from the speakers on the mess hall roof, I was yanked from sleep by the star-spangled banner in honor of Independence Day. Vivian slept right through it. When I climbed to her bunk to wake her, she swatted my hand and said, "Go the fuck away." I did, pretending not to feel hurt as I headed to the latrine to shower and brush my teeth. After that, it was on to the mess hall, where kitchen workers dished out a 4th of July special— pancakes topped with stripes of blueberries, strawberries, and whipped cream. I was told they were called freedom flapjacks. I called them ridiculous. Vivian didn't show up for breakfast, not even fashionably late. Her absence freed Natalie to get a second helping of pancakes, which she consumed with abandon, strawberry sauce staining the corner of her mouth like stage blood. Allison, on the other hand, didn't budge from her routine. She put down her fork after taking 3 bites and said, "I'm so full. Why am I such a pig?" "You can eat more," I urged. "I won't tell Viv." She gave me a hard stare. "What makes you think Vivian has anything to do with what I eat?" "I just thought that I'm like you and do everything she tells me to." I looked down at my plate, more ashamed than offended. I had downed 2/3 of the pancakes without a second thought, yet I knew that if Vivian had been there, I would have consumed only as much as she did. 1 bite or 100, it didn't matter. "Sorry," I said. "I don't do it on purpose, it's just that..." Allison reached across the table and patted my hand. "It's okay. I'm sorry. Vivian's very persuasive." "And a bitch," Natalie added as she slid one of Allison's untouched pancakes onto her own plate. "We get it." "I mean, we're friends," Allison explained. "Best friends, the three of us, but there are times when she can be... a bitch," Natalie said, more emphatically that time. "Viv knows that. Hell, she'd say it herself if she were here." My mind flashed back to the previous day, her witnessing my disastrous attempt to kiss Theo, the smirk playing across her lips afterward. She had yet to bring it up, which worried me. I had expected some mention during the campfire or right before bed. Instead, there had been nothing, and it made me think she was saving it for a later game of 2 truths and a lie, when it could inflict the most emotional damage. "Why do you put up with it?" I said. Allison shrugged. "Why do you?" "Because I like her." But it was more than that. She was the older girl who took me under her wing and shared her secrets. Plus, she was cool and tough and smarter than I thought she let on. To me, that was something worth clinging to. We like her too, Natalie said. And Viv's been through a lot, you know.
But she's sometimes so mean to the two of you.
That's just her way. We're used to it. We've known her for years. All our lives, Natalie chimed in. We knew who she was and what she was like even before we became friends. You know, same school, same neighborhood.
Allison nodded.
We know how to handle her. What she means, Natalie said, is that when Vivian gets in a mood, it's best to stay out of her way until it passes.
I spent the rest of the morning separated from the others in Dogwood, thanks to another advanced archery lesson. I was relegated to the Arts and Crafts building, where the camp's other 13-year-olds and I used leather presses to decorate rawhide bracelets. I would have preferred to shoot arrows. After that, it was lunch. That time, Natalie and Allison also didn't bother to show. Rather than eat alone, I declined the ham and Swiss sandwich on the menu and headed to Dogwood to look for them. To my surprise, I found them before I even reached the cabin. The roar of voices inside told me all three of them were there.
"Don't lecture us about secrets," I heard Natalie yell, "especially when you refused to tell us where you were this morning."
"It doesn't matter where I went," Vivian shouted back. "What matters is that you lied."
"We're sorry," Allison said with all the drama she could muster. "We told you 100 times.
"That's not fucking good enough."
I opened the door to see Natalie sitting shoulder to shoulder with Allison on the edge of her bunk. Vivian stood before them, her face flushed, hair stringy and unwashed. Natalie had her chest thrust forward as if in the process of blocking a field hockey rival. Allison shrank into herself, her hair over her face, trying to hide what looked like tears. All three of them swiveled my way when I entered. The cabin plunged into silence.
"What's going on?" I asked.
"Nothing," Allison replied.
"Just bullshitting," Natalie said.
Only Vivian admitted the obvious truth.
"Emma, we're in the middle of something. Shit needs to be sorted out. Come back later, okay?"
I backed out of the cabin, closing the door behind me and shutting out the raging storm taking place inside. Vivian was apparently having one of those moods Natalie and Allison had warned me about. This time they couldn't stay out of its path. Not sure where else to go, I turned to head back to the center of camp. There was Lottie, standing right behind me. She wore a plaid shirt over a white tee. Her long hair was pulled back in a braid that ran down her back. Like me, she was close enough to hear the commotion coming from Dogwood, and her expression was one of curious surprise.
"Locked out," she said.
"Sort of."
"They'll let you back in soon enough."
Her gaze flicked from me to the cabin door and back again.
"First time living with a group of girls?"
I nodded.
"It takes some getting used to. I was an only child, too, so coming here was a rude awakening."
"You were a camper here?"
"Yes, in my own special way," Lottie said. "But what I learned is that each summer there's always a fight or two in these cabins. It comes from being shoved together in such close quarters."
"This one sounds pretty bad," I said, surprised by how shaken seeing them fighting had left me. I couldn't stop picturing Vivian's cheeks flaring red or the tears glistening behind Allison's hair.
"Well, I know of a friendlier place we can go."
Lottie put a hand on my shoulder, steering me away from the cabin and into the heart of camp. To my surprise, we headed to the lodge, skirting the side of the building to the steps that led to the back deck. At the top stood Franny, leaning against the railing, her eyes aimed at the lake.
"Emma," she said, "what a pleasant surprise."
"There's some drama in Dogwood," Lottie explained.
Franny shook her head.
"I'm not surprised."
"Do you want me to defuse it?"
"No," Franny said. "It'll pass. It always does."
She waved me to her side, and the two of us stared at the water. Lake Midnight spread before us in all its sun-dappled glory.
"Gorgeous view,"
she said. Makes you feel a little bit better, doesn't it? This place makes everything better. That's what my father used to say, and he learned